And good morning. Thank you very much for taking time from your day to start with me. My intentions this morning are to help you and to help me. And how am I going to do that? Well, we're both going to learn together. I hope you have an open mind. And if you have an open mind, then you can learn. And you know, if I say something this morning that you don't agree with, well, you have the right to reject that and do what you want, and that's perfectly fine. But for those that want to listen and they want to learn, then this is a good start. Okay, this program is Health Essentials. Our number here at the station is 903-586-5257. We'll take calls a little bit later, but right now, I want to talk about information that I think is very, very beneficial to you and to everyone that you know and to all your friends. You already know that this is true, but the healthier and the stronger you are, the better you're able to enjoy life and do all those things that you have been created to do. You realize that you were born to do a work. And if you have your health, both mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, the chances are you getting that work done is much, much higher. Now, what I want to do this morning, and I'm telling you right now, I had to cull this stuff down. This could easily become too much information. That's not what I want here. What I want is I want information that's good for everybody, that's easy to implement and do. So this morning, I want to talk about onions. I'm guessing the Farmer's Almanac has already said to plant them. Sounds like something my mother would say, right? Okay. There's one particular substance that is in a relatively high concentration in onions. It's called quercetin. Have you ever heard of quercetin before? Well, if you've been paying attention to the COVID-19, then you have probably heard that quercetin has an amazing potential benefit and value. And so, depending on which studies you read, I could read studies showing that onions, because of the quercetin content, they have such a favorable improvement in the body's production of testosterone. Well, that's interesting. We're not going to talk about that. I've also read articles about quercetin from onions that really helps human beings soothe and help manage the stress levels they have in their life better. Okay, that's interesting, but we're not going to talk about that. One of the aspects, though, is how quercetin greatly helps assist the immune system. One of the ways it does that is by inhibiting how viruses grow or enter the cell and replicate. And so what I want to do is just cover the basic stuff. Everybody knows what an onion is. They have white onions, yellow onions, red onions, purple onions. They're all fabulous. You have several choices here. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to cover a little bit of information. This comes from the American study in the Journal of Food Consumption and Analysis. They try to answer the question, exactly how do you prepare onions in your kitchen? What do you do with them? Okay, here's a study. There is a lot of quercetin that's found in onions. If I'm not mistaken, apples, especially right there near the skin, there is a lot of quercetin also. Which means if you eat these things routinely, guess what you're getting? You're getting the quercetin that our heavenly God and Father created as an amazing flavonoid compound that's found in them. But if you get them raw, it's going to be mainly the glycosylated form of quercetin. But for most people, they're not going to eat onions raw, unless maybe it's on a sandwich or in a salad or cheeseburger or something like that. So most people are going to cook their onions. A gentleman by the name of Kevin Lombard, who is a researcher at New Mexico State University, he asked himself that question. How does the cooking method of the onions affect the amount of quercetin, that vital flavonoid compound that helps defeat viruses? How much does it contain? And so what he did was he went out to several grocery stores, bought a bunch of different onions, and he prepared them in the usually normal ways that somebody would do in their kitchen. And then he determined how much quercetin actually survive the cooking process. Okay, here's the first one. If he simply just baked the onions in the oven for 15 minutes, well, that's interesting. It increased the concentration of quercetin analogs by 7%. Well, isn't that interesting? So as compared to raw, you actually get a little bit more of the quercetin by cooking it. I like that. Here's choice number two. What if we took onions and just boiled them in water? Well, if he boiled the onions for 5 minutes, well, that actually reduced the amount of available quercetin by about 18%. And, of course, I know this makes sense to you. What happens if you take carrots and you boil them in water? What color is the water once the carrots are cooked? Well, it's orange. That's because some of the value or the nutrients from the carrots, they just leak out into the water, which I think that's what my dad used to do, is he would just drink the carrot water or the green water from the spinach. I guess he understood that there was value to it. And so when you boil onions, what do you get? Some of the quercetin is going to leak out of the onion into the water. I guess you can start sipping on your onion water, can't you? Now, what they found was the very best way to prepare onions. Well, how do you preserve the most quercetin? Well, guess which one won the contest? It involved sautéing the onions. And so if you want to say that sautéing is a bit like stir-frying, sure, that works for me. You know, where you take a little bit of oil or butter and you shake the pan around to sauté to keep it from burning. And they noticed that when they sautéed the onions, that actually increased the amount of quercetin analogs in the onion by 25%. I'm telling you. How are you going to survive without liver and onions for sale at Traditions now? It's going to be really hard. You know, there's an old phrase that says an apple a day keeps a doctor away. I think they got that wrong. It should be an onion a day keeps a doctor away. I read the brief article about the woman that died this last week. She was from Iowa. And I don't really remember the town in Iowa, but it said they asked her when she was, and I can't remember now, she was either 113, 114, 115, somewhere around there. So if I miss it by 2 years, please forgive me. But she was literally holding the record as the oldest living American on American soil. So I thought that was pretty cool. And they asked her, what is the number one thing that has kept you alive this long? You know what she said? Hard work. See, their hard work doesn't kill you. See, God knows exactly what he's doing by giving us work. Everything that he has created for us is to benefit us. So planting onions, guess who wins? You do, you do, you do. And so do all your children and your relatives and your friends that you share the onions with. Everybody wins. You know what number two was on her list? She said, keep away from doctors. I'm not going to go into that, but you know as well as I do that there's a lot of dicey things that can go wrong with prescription drugs and medications. And there's always a lot of things that can go wrong if you require a surgery. Maybe what she's really saying is, between hard work and taking good care of myself and being my own best advocate, I tried to minimize the amount of times I went to a doctor for help. Does that sound reasonable? Okay. Number three, she allowed herself to indulge in sweets. And I don't really remember what she said was, but I think she said she would allow herself once a week to have some birthday cake or something like that. Okay, interesting to me. I like reading about stuff like that, though, because I don't think I've read about somebody living to the age of 114 saying, I got there by going to the doctor every time I had a sniffle, or by being as lazy as possible. No. You were born for hard labor and for work. Okay, now this is the article that I really wanted to cover last week, and I find it so interesting. But I didn't get to cover it, so I'm going to cover it now. And I really think this information is too good to pass up. I do not want to be guilty of not covering this topic with you. Okay, now this one is primarily for men. because it has to do with prostate cancer. But I want everyone to listen to it as if maybe there is a legitimate benefit for a woman, even though she didn't have a prostate. If you're a woman with a prostate, maybe we should do an article on you. I'm just joking. By the way, I know it's possible for biological men to have prostate cancer, and now all the websites are saying that transgender women can develop prostate cancer also. I'm sorry, I don't understand that. Okay, here's the article right here. Okay, the title is quercetin, which I just told you comes from onions. You get some from apples too. Quercetin is able to boost the inhibitory effect of green tea when it comes to suppressing the growth of prostate cancer. Actually, the truth of it is, every single man that's listening right now, whether you're a man baby that's 2 years old or you're 102 years old, you need this information. And actually, the other group of men that probably need this the most are the ones that don't have any problems yet. I don't know if you've ever heard of this concept, but it's called a preemptive strike. Some people call it getting ahead of the curve, or they want to take good care of themselves before they develop a disease. That's the concept here. And so which one has the greatest value? Doing things to prevent a disease from occurring, or just waiting until you have a catastrophic failure in your body and then you go to the doctor and they say, oh, we're going to really help you here? Okay, well, you get to choose, though. Everybody has a free will choice. You get to make your own decisions. Okay, men in the early stages of prostate cancer, they may be able to slow down the course of their disease by drinking 5 cups of green tea and taking 1 gram of quercetin a day. Okay, experiments on mice brought nutritionists at the University of California in Los Angeles to this conclusion. They published their research in the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry in the year 2014. Can you believe that? That was 9 years ago. I'm just now getting a hold of it, or I just now found it. But just because it was 9 years ago doesn't mean that they have discredited the study. Okay, here it comes. Here it goes right here. In the year 2006, researchers at the University of Parma, that's the University of Parma, not the University of Parmesan, they published the results of an experiment in which they had given 60 men, you know, that's 6 times 10 men. These men were in the early stages of prostate cancer. They were either given a placebo, which I know you know what a placebo is, but it's a, let's just say it's a capsule. It's a sham, a therapeutic agent. It doesn't have any value to it at all. But they give it to you, and then they compare what their other substance, how it compares against it for healing the body. So they gave 60 men in the early stages of prostate cancer a placebo. Or, what's the second choice? A daily dose of 600 milligrams of green tea extract for 1 year. And actually, I like it when I come across stories like this, because what it speaks of is being very purposeful. Okay, what are you going to do here? You're going to take a capsule that has 600 milligrams of the extract from green tea, and so that'd be the equivalent of what you'd find, or the medicinal value maybe, or the flavonoids, or the polyphenols that you'd find in the equivalent of 5 cups of green tea, but they just put it in capsule form. Maybe to make it interesting. This comes from the journal Cancer Research, 2006, January the 15th. So tomorrow, that will have been, let me see, 6 from 23, 17 years ago. Isn't that amazing? At the end of the trial that year, the trial lasted... I'm reading that wrong. At the end of the year that the trial lasted, the researchers found tumors. And remember, these were all men that were at the beginning stages of prostate cancer, okay? course, if you were a man, would you want to just try the placebo? No. You want what's going to help you. So at the end of this one-year trial, the men that had the beginnings of prostate cancer that just took the placebo, they found tumors in 9 of the 30 men in the placebo group. Do you get that? Okay. But in the group of men where they took a capsule of 600 milligrams of the catechins that were found in green tea, guess what they found as far as men with tumors there? 1. So those that were on the placebo that had the beginnings of prostate cancer, 9 of the 30 men at the end of the year, they found tumors in their prostate. You get that? But those that took the green tea extract, they only found 1 tumor. Now, I don't know about you or how you think about this, but to me, that's impressive. And according to this, this Italian trial that was done at the University of Parma, it seems suggests to us that green tea is very, very protective against prostate cancer. Are you with me on that? So if you're a man, you need to remember this, okay? Now, there are more studies that say this may not be that accurate, and they're saying, well, how do we know that's really true? Anyway, let me change the topic slightly, but it's really the same topic. So they're asking the question, what about the flavonoid compound that you get from onions called quercetin? What about it? So researchers at the University of California, they wondered whether they could enhance the protective effect of green tea by adding the flavonoid quercetin. And you'll be really interested to know it shows its structural metabolic formula. No, you can't see it. I'm looking at it. I'm just joking with you. Okay, the Americans at the University of California, they tested their theory on mice. And what they're doing is they're trying to find out, adding quercetin to green tea, does that help prostate cancer? Okay. They're just trying to find out if the quercetin helps the green tea become more potent at inhibiting the prostate cancer. Okay. So the Americans tested their theory on mice that they had injected with human prostate cancer cells. Are you with me so far? So they took laboratory mice and they injected them with prostate cancer cells. I am guessing that means one thing. They're all going to develop prostate cancer. The animals in the experimental group were given an extract of green tea in their drinking water. That's probably the easiest way to get them to take it. Just make some tea and let them drink that for their water. The human equivalent of that dose that the mice were given was about 5 to 6 cups of green tea a day. But because mice are much smaller, the dose is less. You get that. Now, some of the mice were given food that contained either 0.2 or 0.4% quercetin. And I'm guessing they got that from onions. And for all I know, maybe they gave them Purina mouse chow, which mice will eat just about anything. I've heard they do not like peanut butter. No, I'm only joking. Or peanuts. They love those things. So the human equivalent of the doses that the mice were given was about 1 or 2 grams of quercetin a day. That'd be the same as 1,000 milligrams or 2,000 milligrams. Are you with me? And it shows right here, the figure below, I know you can't see that, it shows that the green tea extract slowed down the growth of the tumor. Remember, these mice were injected with living aggressive strains of human prostate cancer. And they showed that the inhibitory effect of the extract increased the more quercetin that the mice had in their food. Now, you cannot see the chart that I'm looking at, but they have the control group. They have those that had green tea. They had some that had 0.2% of the quercetin, 0.4. Then they had the green tea and then the quercetin. And I'm telling you right now, it shows the longer that these mice live, yes, the tumors grow, but the greatest suppression of the tumors was when they had green tea with quercetin. The figure above shows, I know you can't see the chart. I'm looking at the chart, though. Just trust me on this. The figure above shows that the more quercetin the mice had been given, the more bioactive ingredients from the green tea, the researchers found in the tumors. Now, that's interesting right there to me. Because what it's telling you is, when they would do an autopsy and go and look at the tumors that were made up of human prostate cancer cells, they would actually identify compounds of green tea that actually made it to the tumors. Does that make sense? So you got to understand here that when you drink green tea, some of those flavonoids, they take this route. I don't know where they go or what they do, but guess where they end up? They end up at their targeted destination, which is the prostate. That's, to me, that's interesting. The researchers were also able to ascertain that administration of both quercetin, which is a flavonoid, and green tea extract, they inhibited the synthesis of these tumors, and they boosted the activity of what are called suicide genes in the tumor cells. You know what that means? If you take green tea and you take quercetin and you get it into your mouth and swallow it, it's telling the tumors in the prostate to go ahead and die. It's like they're getting this message, instead of living forever, we need you guys to go ahead and die right now. That's actually kind of like a simple definition of a cancer. Cancer cells, they refuse to die. They're supposed to. Every cell in the human body is supposed to do its work. And once it reaches the end of its usefulness, like it's a bit exhausted or worn out, then it needs to be removed by the immune system and then replaced with a brand new cell, like, for example, a new prostate cell. Yeah. And so green tea and quercetin, they send the chemical signal into the tumor or the cancer, and they tell it it's time to die. All right? Now, obviously, this is done on mice with green tea and quercetin. So what they're saying now is they want to do a future human intervention study to see if this really works on human prostate cancer. Hey, I'm all for that. Okay, next article. This one is really, really good, too. And it's so simple. You know, some people, they have within them a desire to take every drug known to man. And for them, they're not happy unless they've got a stockpile of Mucinex D, they've got bottle after bottle of Tylenol, because who knows when you're going to have a crisis in the world and you're going to have your Tylenol. And then they got their Tylenol PM with Benadryl, because they can't sleep at night, and they want to make sure they never run out. And so, yeah, there's people like that. I find it hard to believe, but I know it's true because I talk to them. But there's other people, they think, you know, something's not right here. If our bodies aren't working right, what do we do to help ourselves? And for some of these people, they love the idea of natural remedies. Because what's the side effect of a natural remedy? Like an onion, for example. Well, yes, maybe momentarily your breath could reek of onions. But if everybody in the family's eating onions, you're not going to be able to tell, right? Okay, here's the next article right here. This is for the people that want to make natural choices to help themselves. And the thing of it is, it's your choice. If you tell me that you want to load up on drugs, pharmaceutical drugs like Fosamax to build your bones, go ahead and do it. It's fine. But if you want an alternative to that and find out, is there something better that we can do? Is there a different model that we can look at where we could actually help the bones to grow and become stronger? Well, then you might want to know that. Okay. Here's the abstract right here. The more onions you eat, the stronger your bones are. If you consume onions daily, you may reduce the chance of breaking a bone by more than 40%. Here's a study right here. In the year 2009, a researcher by the name of Eric Matheson, who's a medical researcher at the Medical University of South Carolina, published an epidemiological study in which he analyzed data from, who did he use in the study? Well, only 507 postmenopausal women. In order to be in the study, you had to had gone through menopause, which means you're no longer cycling the exactly 28 days like normal. So you've gone from the fertility years, you've switched gears, your body's more into postmenopause now. Does it mean your ovaries and the adrenals and the thyroid still don't produce hormones? They're supposed to. But what they did was they took 507 postmenopausal women. The other reason why this is significant, and I realize you already know this, is postmenopausal women that have all the issues. They have the greatest chance of cancer. They absolutely have the greatest risk of heart attacks. You know, if a man has a heart attack, the likelihood of him surviving is real high. If a woman has a heart attack, those numbers go way, way down. Much harder to survive. I mean, anyway, you could look at the news just this week alone. Several famous women have died this week from heart attacks, and they were in their 50s. Okay? The data was collected in the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey that was performed 2003 to 2004. So that's right at 20 years old. The women had completed questionnaires about their dietary habits. In addition, scans had been made of their bones, which that might be called a DEXA scan, or a, you know, where they check to see if your bones are really dense, hard, and thick, or if they're really porous and thin and brittle, as in osteoporosis, or if they're becoming thin, osteopenia. Matheson used these scans to determine bone density. And what you already understand is that the greater the bone density, usually that equates to the stronger the bone, right? Okay, Matheson mainly looked at the intake of onions. Well, I wonder why he focused on that. Well, here you go. In animal studies, animal feed to which onions have been added, it's been shown to protect the bones against breaking down prematurely. That comes from the journal Nature, 1999, the September edition, volume 23, pages 343 to 344. This is probably mainly due to a compound called sulfoxides. And the one that they mentioned, I know this is horrible, the chemical that they're measuring is called gamma-L-glutamyl-trans-S1-propanol-L-cysteine-sulfoxide in onions. I know you're so thankful I read that out to you. But that's the name of the specific compound that they're measuring. Now you know why I don't want to do that, because it's just too much. So these cysteine sulfoxides, they inhibit bone cells that break down tissue, which that's a normal process. This is supposed to happen. But when you eat onions, it just helps that process, in what the net benefit is, you get to keep stronger bones longer than someone that doesn't eat these cysteine sulfoxides that come from onions. And so, in addition, now this is fascinating. I started to copy articles about this, but I just didn't do it because I thought to myself, this is just too much to cover in one day. But they show that onion consumption tends to stimulate the body's production of testosterone. Well, if you're a woman above the age of 50, or if you're a man above the age of 50, you might want to pay attention to that. So what is the result here? They showed specifically in these postmenopausal women, there were 507 of them, as you remember, the more often that the women ate onions, the greater their bone density. And they had it broken down into like four categories. Here you go. One group of women that ate onions just once a month, they were at the lowest end of the bone strength. Those that ate onions twice a month, well, guess what? Their bones were a little bit stronger. Women that had onions 3 to 6 times a week, maybe that's all in one day, I don't know. But they had onions 3 to 6 times a week, their bones were even stronger. Guess who had the strongest bones of all time? Well, in this study, is women that had onions once a day. How do you like that? At the first glance, the effect found of frequent consumption of onions is modest. They have 5% more bone density in the group with the highest intake compared to the lowest intake. Well, you tell me, would you like your bones to be 5% thicker and stronger? Listen to this one right here. According to a meta study published in the British Medical Journal, smokers aged 70, they have 4% less bone density than their non-smoking peers. Folks, I'm not making this stuff up. At the same time, these smokers are 41% more likely to break a bone than non-smokers. That comes from the British Medical Journal. The year is 1997. So what's the message here? Frequent onion consumption seems to be associated with increased bone density and may be an area for future research. I'm thinking that maybe if you eat onions all day long, the chances of somebody tripping over you and breaking your bones is very low because the onions keep vampires. Never mind. That's a different topic. I'm sorry. If you want to join me on the radio this morning, please feel free to call me right now. The number is 903-586-5257. If you have a question, if you want to try to understand something about how to improve your symptoms, I mean, after all these physical symptoms that a human being experiences, whether it's a headache or an ache or a pain, or maybe you've got bloating, but your body's telling you something is not working right. And what you want to do is you want to try to figure out, what can I do to help myself? It always works out for the best when a person takes full responsibility for their health. They don't blame the nurses. They don't blame the doctor. They say, it's up to me to figure this out. And you know what? That can start by asking questions, right? What do I do to help myself? Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning. I would like for you to talk about Alzheimer's. Is there anything you can do to prevent it? My sister died with it, and I have a good friend that has been diagnosed with it, and I would just like to know more about it. You see so many things at the drugstore now, take this to prevent Alzheimer's and all that. So would you just address that and
yes, ma'am.
Talk as much you can about it, and I'll just hang up and listen on the radio.
Okay, thank you for your question. Appreciate you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, I'm going to cover it from my perspective, though, and this is just one very simple point. And what I did was, last night I looked up an article, and I started to copy it off, but it was about 30 pages long. I said, maybe I shouldn't copy that off. Anyway, so I'm only covering this from one perspective. Are you with me on that? So I'm not trying to say this is the whole enchilada. So what I want to do is, I want to tie several things together. And at first, it may not make sense. Okay, here goes. I found an article online last night. I think it was published in the National Institutes of Health, which means it had been peer-reviewed, thoroughly studied, and compared, but it came from Spain. And what they did was, in this study, all they did was they compared what are called ferritin levels with people that have diabetes. Now, I'll get to it in just a moment, but maybe I'll give you like a heads up. Sometimes what they do is they'll call Alzheimer's, the other name for it is type 3 diabetes, or if you want to call it diabetes of the brain, just any simple way that you can kind of like hang your hat on the topic where you can understand it. So let's just say, for example, that's what Alzheimer's is diabetes of the brain, okay? You got issues with blood sugar being too high. Your body doesn't respond to it. So in the article last night, all they did was they tried to measure the amount of ferritin, which ferritin is a protein produced by all mammals that I know of. I don't know what it's like in reptiles or goldfish, but I know about mammals, which you could say that a human being is a mammal. But ferritin is this protein mainly produced by either the reticulocytes or the hepatocytes of your liver. And what ferritin does is it's like a storage hormone for iron. But the way that I really, really want to say it is, Ferritin is a protein that tries to grab and capture unbound, old, rusted iron that's just floating around your body that's wreaking havoc. And so here's the problem. The more rusted iron that you have in your tissues or your cells or your blood, the more your body is going to rust. The correct term, it's called oxidation. And so they asked the question, what are blood sugar levels among people that donate blood? And so I don't remember exactly all the numbers or the raw data when it came to the ferritin levels of diabetics, but this is what it showed. If they would donate blood and lower their ferritin, guess what would happen? Their glucose or their blood sugar would come down. Now, I'm going to try to explain a different point of the article. And this may be hard to grasp, but at least you can say you've heard it one time. Do you know what the term insulin resistance is? What it means is your body, the cells of your body, they just don't respond to the hormone insulin like they used to. And one of the roles of insulin is getting sugar from the bloodstream into the cell where it can be burned for fuel. Ideally, this is a good, normal, healthy process. Insulin also helps shuttle other nutrients and protein into the cells where they can be used by the cell for life and for homeostasis. And so what they're showing is that when your muscles are full of old rusted iron, they don't respond to insulin anymore. And so if somebody's, say, 45 years of age or 50 years of age, and their body is drastically changing for the worse, well, you might assume that they're developing diabetes. So the reason that I'm bringing this up is because they have demonstrated in human studies that one of the ways to stop all the oxidation and all the free radical damage and all the rusting is to get rid of the ferritin. You can do that by, number one, don't eat enriched fortified foods. If you eat enriched fortified foods, you're asking for it because they add iron dust to all that. Kind of like the article I read about cigarette smokers having weaker bones and a 41% increased risk of having a broken bone. Well, all tobacco, they soak it in iron dust. And so when you smoke a cigarette, guess what you're doing? You're breathing in iron. And that iron gets trapped in the tissues and it begins to rust. Switching the topic just slightly, the number one absolute predictor of who's going to have the roughest go with COVID infections, the marker is ferritin. The higher that is, it's going to go badly for you. I don't know how I can make what I'm saying any more simple. I'm telling you straight up, if you know somebody that's died of COVID, it's because their ferritin levels were high. They were full of old rust. I don't know how else I can say that more simply, but at some point we've got to grasp this concept that if we're overloading our bodies with iron, we're asking for it. Now, the lady called and asked about Alzheimer's. I came across another article where they actually took, and this is probably the simplest way for me to say it. You know how some people, I still remember this like it was yesterday. My very first day of college, they introduced us to what was called the human cadaver lab. There wasn't any buildup. You had to show up. There was a huge walk-in refrigerator where they kept the cadavers. And I realize this may be a very unpleasant topic, but in my mind, I can still see it like it was yesterday. And so in the group of anatomy students that I was in, I was assigned a human cadaver. I think the guy was like 74 years of age. He had advanced COPD. He had other issues. But the whole point is that the human body is your teacher. And so when you start doing human cadaver dissection, you get a real-world look at what everything really looks like. And you get to identify structures like, here's the vagus nerve, and here's the carotid artery, and this is what a jugular vein looks like when somebody has COPD, and this is what a lung looks like when they have, you know, when they've spent 50 years smoking cigarettes. You could just imagine. But some people, what they do is when they have dementia or Alzheimer's, when they were in their right mind, they decide, what I'm going to do is I'm going to donate my body to science, and that way medical students, when they start learning how to care for the human body and how to treat disease and how to make the world a better place, which is what they all want to do, just like me. I'm going to donate my body to see if I can learn something. How can we gain mastery over disease where we can prevent it? Well, one study that was done recently, what they did was they took, there's a structure at the center of the brain between the right and the left hemisphere. It's called the hippocampus. If you've never heard of the hippocampus, well, that's where all short-term memory takes place. And so one of the hallmarks of a person that has Alzheimer's is they have this interruption of short-term memory. And you know what I'm talking about if you've experienced it. So, for example, if a relative tells you a story, you know, what do? 5 minutes later, they tell you the same story over again as if they have no memory of just telling you 5 minutes earlier, or in some cases, 10 seconds earlier. I remember I had a young man bring his grandfather to see me, and the story just kept being repeated over and over and over again. And so when the hippocampus is not working properly and it's damaged and diseased, that's at the basis of Alzheimer's. And if I'm not mistaken, there's two or three ways that they're going to diagnose this besides the obvious ones, just observing. You know they have Alzheimer's. And so an MRI is performed, that's magnetic resonance imaging, and if they image that the hippocampus has significant shrinkage or atrophy, then they'll say, bingo, now we can diagnose them. They have Alzheimer's because their hippocampus is shrunk, and so therefore they have the short-term issues. They don't bathe. They stay up all hours. They do crazy things. Anyway, you already know all that. So when the hippocampus is what suffers, you get Alzheimer's. So in this human cadaver research, you know, topic, what they did was they would section, kind of like they would take sections of the hippocampus, and lo and behold, what do they find? High amounts of iron rusting away. The pause is because I want you to get that when you eat a bunch of processed foods, and you consume food that's heavily enriched and fortified, the iron's got to go somewhere. And your body's just trying to get rid of it, so it deposits in tissues. And thus, you're going to develop Alzheimer's or dementia. Not good. What's the solution? Stop eating processed food. Eat real food that God Himself has made. What is so bizarre about eating 4 eggs and an avocado for breakfast? Why is that bizarre? It's not. It's real. What is bizarre about eating a salad with a fresh organic chicken on top, with olive oil vinaigrette salad dressing, with avocado and tomatoes and walnuts, and everything else that you like? It's called, you got to eat real food. You have to. And so I don't know what exactly your angle is on it, but once you get all that iron and it rusts and damages and destroys, those are things that are hard to reverse. If anybody tells you can just take a bottle of Focus Factor and reverse that, they're nuts. That don't work that way. It does not. What you want to do is you want to get ahead of the curve, and you want to turn this around before somebody becomes diseased and sick. So in the study, my first thought was, well, what is the simplest way to lower the ferritin load? Well, it's to donate blood. There's other things you have to look at. One of the things that I'm just gonna be real blunt and honest with you. If you ever remember the name Dr. Hugh Fundenberg, very, very famous gerontologist, which means his studies were geared toward taking care of older people. And he said every single year that you get a flu vaccine, if you do it for 3 to 4 consecutive years, there's like a 700 to 800% increase in the risk that you're going to develop Alzheimer's later in life. And I realize this is one of those topics that nobody likes to cover because it's just so offensive to a lot of people, because you've got some people that say you can never ever be harmed by a vaccine. And there's other people that say, oh my goodness, they're offering vaccines for being, having low IQs. I'm getting all those I can. I need the help. It just doesn't work that way. And so they use compounds like mercury and aluminum What the heck do you think happens to mercury and aluminum when you inject it directly into your immune system? It's going to go somewhere. Just like I told you the study earlier about men that had, or the mice they injected with human prostate cancer cells. When they gave the mice green tea and quercetin, guess what happened when they opened up the prostate tumors? They noticed that green tea had been able to make it in there. Well, why is this so far-fetched that if you take a vaccine that's loaded up with heavy amounts of mercury and aluminum, you just think that's just magically going to dissipate into thin air and it's just going to be absorbed in the atmosphere like diesel exhaust? No. It's going to be soaked up by your precious gland called, or tissue called the hippocampus. You know, there was a study years ago that where it was on the radio. I think it was UT Tyler that did it. But they said, this is just ridiculous. The use of aluminum-containing antiperspirants has nothing to do with the development of breast cancer. Well, I bet you 2 weeks later, there was a study that showed when they removed the cancerous breast cancer. That was redundant, sorry. When they removed sections of the breast cancer or the tumors, guess what they found high concentrations of in the cancer? Aluminum. Folks, I can't make this stuff up. Have you ever heard the term forever chemicals? You've got no business rubbing aluminum or mercury or lead all over your body. Don't you remember that when they had that lead smelter in Dallas, they showed in a 5-mile area, the IQ was so low. You could build a case that the more lead you have in your body, the worse the brain functions. What do we need in America? What do we need? We need more people that love to work and to be productive and to be useful and to make the world a better place. Doesn't the Bible tell us that whatever you do, in word or deed, do all for the name of the Lord? Whatsoever your hands find to do, do it with all your might or your strength, as serving God, not man. We're commanded in the Bible to make the world a better place. Well, how are you going to do that if you're full of lead or aluminum or mercury? I think they're estimating by the year 2050, and I realize that's 27 years from now, there's going to be so much Alzheimer's and dementia, it's literally going to break the economy because we cannot afford to pour out that much money to the care and the feeding and the taking care of these people with Alzheimer's. It's just going to be horrible. So that's why I'm telling you these things. You've got to wrap your mind around the idea that prevention is about a million times better than treatment with drugs. It just is, because then it's going to be too little too late. I know, I see all these studies about drug trials where they use this pharmaceutical drug and that one for Alzheimer's. Can I just say this? Since I've been doing this for a living, and I love doing it, let's just say since the year 1989, I have read about endless new drugs that are going to be the next greatest thing since sliced bread to do away with Alzheimer's and dementia and diabetes. Let me see, this is the year 2023, so that's 34 years. I have never seen one work yet. I've heard lots of promises and lots of buildup, but it's never panned out. So I know that's what they do. Of course, you know what they're really doing. They want investors to pour money into it. And then if the FDA actually approves it, guess what they're going to do? Oh, well, it's released for market. It only costs $3,000 a month. Wow, yippee. What does it do? It improves symptoms by 1%. Well, that's not much to brag about. Prevention is always the very best model. You know how it says in the book of Hosea, my people are destroyed from what? A lack of knowledge. Well, it's because we've rejected the knowledge that God wants to have. So, I am always just baffled at the number of people that never, ever read. They don't pick up a book. They read pictures. They can look at pictures of cars or deer on the internet, But as far as reading, it just escapes me. How are you supposed to learn how to care and feed for the human body if you don't read? Well, you can listen to this program. What did we learn today? Onions, apples, keep the doctor away. You know what? All jokes aside, what if this is all that you did today, was just set your mind like eating onions every day for the next month and just put it to the test and see how you feel? I mean, the article that I didn't cover, it greatly improves testosterone levels in men and women. The last time I checked, even women postmenopausally, they need a little bit of testosterone to be able to build strong, healthy bones. So, what I want you to do is, these are the things I would look at. Do a blood test. And here's my next point on Alzheimer's. Everybody's all about doing what's called a lipid profile. They want to measure total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, triglycerides, HDL. There's one called VLDL, or the very low density lipoprotein. They want to do that, and they want to say it has this great meaning. Well, if you've ever heard of a blood test called homocysteine, homocysteine levels, that is 40 times more predictive of a coming cardiovascular issue than a lipid profile is. I mean, literally, cholesterol numbers pale in comparison. Actually, it's just disgusting, because low cholesterol usually means death and more heart attacks. I know you've heard this before, but probably two-thirds of all heart attacks are when somebody has cholesterol below 180. So that model is not exactly super-duper accurate here, folks. If you really want to figure out what's going on in the body, well, why don't you measure homocysteine levels? Because then we can start talking about what nutrients is a human being lacking that they need. For example, in order to keep your body or brain from going bad, you got to have some B12. Vitamin B12, what's the greatest source? Well, the greatest one I know of is calf liver. Where are you going to go get liver and onions now? Serve at a restaurant. It's got to be somewhere. Or you cook it at home, or you take supplements of calf liver. And so homocysteine, they've shown that when that's above 8, you're asking for Alzheimer's to develop. It's just a question of, do you have the ambition, the motivation, the willingness to learn? Are you going to acquire wisdom and knowledge? What do I do if my homocysteine levels are elevated? And one way, you get to take care of yourself and take responsibility. The other way, you're just waiting for something to break down. That is a model that sucks. It's horrible. Is that really the way that you want to have good health? Is you're just going to wear your body out, abuse it, not take good care of it? And then when you develop a catastrophic issue like Alzheimer's, then you're going to finally start doing something? Well, then it's just about too late. I'm not saying it's always too late, but it's so hard when you've got all this excessive damage and oxidation. So my main point is, you got to get the blood sugar under control. You got to start feeding the body any foods that are good for the brain, like salmon and sardines, ocean fish, eggs, avocados, salads, olive oil. All that's great. Vegetables. And the fruit that is absolutely phenomenal is called berries. Have you ever heard of blueberries or strawberries or raspberries, black currants? The reason I said that is because I tried some black currant powder that you add to water. What about pomegranates? All that stuff's good. But if your homocysteine is elevated, that means you're predisposed and at risk of developing Alzheimer's. What if there's another blood test called MCV? That stands for mean corpuscular volume. When I say mean, I don't mean abusive and angry and treating somebody very, very badly. That's not what I mean. Mean referring to the term average. Maybe that's a closer definition. So if you look at mean corpuscular volume, when it starts going above 94, you're headed toward Alzheimer's, as if that's your weakness. But if your ferritin levels for a man are above 50, that means your brain's rusting out. And if you're a woman, if they're somewhere between 20 and 30 or above that, you're getting into the territory where you're going to start to rust out. And the more rusting you have, the more oxidation you have. Oxidation is the same thing as free radical damage. And so if I took a nail and scraped the top coat of the clear coat of paint off your car and it exposed the bare sheet metal, you tell me, how long does it take for that metal to start to rust? The problem is somebody's done this for 70 years and they haven't noted anything different. They've had plenty of alcohol. They consume a lot of sugar. The higher the sugar content of the diet, guess what happens? You tend to absorb more iron. When you drink a lot of alcohol, what happens? You absorb more iron. It also beats the crap out of your liver. I think fatty livers are basically epidemic proportions these days. So, this program's Health Essentials. I'm here to help you by teaching you a better way. And one of the better ways is by using natural medicine. I think some of the studies show that turmeric helps prevent excessive iron oxidation. Okay, that's interesting. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
God bless you and Happy New Year's, Dr. Morgan.
Yes, ma'am.
I know you only have a few minutes, but I have a question. Can you cover on next Saturday, Lord willing, how to get more air into your lungs? I was diagnosed with a really bad case of asthma, and they're putting me on an inhaler. I really don't want that, but if there's anything natural that I can do.
Well, tell me, what are your ferritin levels?
I don't know.
Well, can you ask your doctor? What's your homocysteine level?
I don't know any of that right now.
Well, then a simple blood test called a CBC, complete blood count with differential, that is warranted right now. And number two, have them do a comprehensive metabolic panel and then have them do ferritin and homocysteine. When you call me back and tell me what the numbers are, then I'll tell you what to do.
Okay, I'll try to remember all that.
Well, do you have a pencil handy?
I do.
Okay.
And I'm sure I have that information. I can go in there where it's at.
Yeah. And so it's called CBC. That's the first one. CBC. The second one is CMP. It stands for Comprehensive Metabolic Panel. The third one is homocysteine. That's spelled H-O-M-O-C-Y-S-T-E-I-N-E. I may have misspelled it. It's called homocysteine. And then the last one's called ferritin. Because if you go through this process and just say, hey, Dr. Morgan, I want you to magically cure my lungs. If you don't address all the reasons behind them, and so you've got a bunch of waste and debris in your body that we have to clean out. And then, obviously, what do we do for the lungs? Well, we got to retrain them to do their job properly. Are you doing any deep breathing exercises right now?
I can't breathe in too deep.
Why not?
I don't know.
Well, how about you go to YouTube and look? Go to YouTube and type in diaphragm exercises, or look up what's called the breathing cure and start watching the exercises. That's the only way you're going to be able to conquer this.
Breathing exercises?
Yep. Mm-hmm. You can't do it without them.
Diaphragm exercise and breathing exercise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look up the breathing cure.
Breathing cure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you, and you have a blessed rest of your day.
Yes, ma'am. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.